You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. The future is coming. Make it brighter with Squarespace. Squarespace makes it easy to turn your idea into a unique website. Showcase your work, blog, or publish content, even sell products and services of all kinds in just a few clicks. You can customize everything from look and feel to settings and products using beautiful templates created by world-class designers. And there's nothing to install, patch, or upgrade ever. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code KICK to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Again, that's squarespace.com and offer code KICK. And now, enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Unlike many actors, Academy Award winner Tim Robbins didn't dream of stardom or a big Hollywood payday. From an early age, he dreamt of starting a theater company. 37 years ago, straight out of college and at the very beginning of his career, Robbins co-founded the Actors Gang, which has since become one of the most innovative and acclaimed theater companies in America. And for Robbins, it's been a lab of sorts where he pushes the envelope of story and technique and a creative North Star that keeps him focused on his craft and immune to the trappings of celebrity. Today, Tim Robbins comes on the podcast to talk about how he funded his first play while he was still a struggling actor, how his latest play, The New Colossus, is putting personal faces to the immigration issue, and why he's using the Actors Gang to bring theater into California prisons. Tim discusses how his new HBO series, Here and Now, is tapping into the cultural zeitgeist and addressing a range of problems from racial tension and political divisions to social media and political correctness. He shares his thoughts on the state of the entertainment industry, how Harvey Weinstein reminds him of shady operators he encountered growing up in New York's Greenwich Village, and how he studied to prepare for his role as a ruthless studio exec in Robert Altman's The Player. He talks about how Altman mentored him and helped him make the leap from actor to director on his first film, Bob Roberts, and why the classic political mockumentary seems more relevant now than ever. Plus, Tim opens up about turning 60, weighs in on the current struggle for the soul of the Democratic Party, laments a $500 check he wrote to ultra-conservative Michelle Bachmann, and recalls the time he heckled Henry Kissinger outside a famous celebrity restaurant. Coming up with Tim Robbins in just a moment. Today I'm sitting down with Oscar-winning actor, director, writer, and occasional musician Tim Robbins. He's starring in the new Alan Ball series, Here and Now, on HBO, and he's directed a fascinating new play called The New Colossus at the theater company that he helped found, the Actors Gang in L.A. Tim Robbins, thanks for joining me.
Pleasure to be here.
Or I guess I'm joining you, technically. I walked into your studio. I've really been enjoying, I have to say, watching your new show Here and Now on HBO. Notwithstanding the title, it really feels like it's tapping into the moment and the cultural zeitgeist with the divisiveness and the racial tension and our obsessions with social media and all kinds of outrage, manufactured or otherwise. Are these the kind of issues that you spend a lot of time thinking about right now?
I think we're all thinking about them. We're all dealing with them. I'm really glad to be in a show that is bringing that question up, is presenting that reality. I love pieces that result in discussion, conversation, that are provocative in that way. And I believe Alan Ball is doing that with Here and Now.
Yeah, and what is it like to work with Alan Ball? I mean, so much of his work seems to be tinged with mystery and metaphor. Half the time, I feel that he's just screwing with my head. When you're acting in an Alan Ball series, does he clue you in on the big picture, or does he just kind of dole that information out on a need-to-know basis?
I think it's important on a need-to-know basis. Our job is to find what the truth of each scene is and trust in the writers and the person that's leading the writers to take us thematically where they want to go. Mm-hmm. I trust him because I believe the script that I read, the pilot script, I said yes to because I loved that he was painting on this very large canvas. Something that is essentially a story about a family, but is really talking about much larger issues than that.
And your character is sort of going through this existential crisis at the moment he turns 60. You're just a few months shy of your 60th birthday. Are you a little afraid that you're going to completely lose your shit when you hit the big 6-0? or do you think that you've pretty much got things under control at this point in your life?
Pretty happy, pretty content right now with my life. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I am not Greg.
Yeah.
Okay. I have a different way of dealing with things than Greg does.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he's indicative of a lot of people that, you know, reach a certain age in their life and, you know, they act out in unhealthy ways. Their whatever despair they're going through or crisis they're going through or lack of faith in themselves. And oftentimes it results in behavior that's detrimental to the people around them.
And it's interesting to see a philosophy professor having this existential crisis. is that something that you've had to do research into, or do you consider yourself a philosopher or a student of philosophy?
I took a philosophy course in college, and I have to say I was pretty confused.
Yeah. so you relate to the character.
Ultimately, I'm more of a man of action than someone that'll sit around debating what thinking about thinking is. But the character, I love that he's a philosophy professor because I can introduce different concepts,
mm-hmm.
and the writers could introduce different concepts of different philosophical camps. And I always find that fascinating to process what's happening right now through different philosophical mm-hmm. theorem.
And now must be an interesting time to do that too.
Right. And it's also a way to get lost too, because ultimately you can think a lot about something and nothing can get done. Mm-hmm. So right now in particular, my major concern is that we as a society don't get lost in our opposition mm-hmm. to something. There's so much energy daily being given over to negativity, echo chambers of resistance or opposition. And I often wonder if we were to take that collective time that we spend saying nasty things about certain people and were to take that time and actually apply it to a conscious life. Knocking on a door and saying hello to somebody, as simple as that.
Yeah.
Or tutoring a kid for an hour a day that you could be on social media blasting the president. There's many things we can do to make things better, and my fear is that we're getting lost in our anger.
Yeah, and it's so easy to do when you wake up and you go on your Twitter feed or you go on your news feed, and it's just all negativity, all Trump, all the time. I mean, it can completely dominate your every thought if you allow it to.
It also might be detrimental to what else can happen in bed in the morning.
That's true.
Right?
That's true. Yeah, what a wasted opportunity. But
a buzzkill right there. And by the way, we're doing it at night when we go to sleep, too.
Yeah. It's almost like it's replaced when people used to probably pray or whatever people would do at the beginning and end
or
of their day.
Cuddle.
Yeah.
Right?
It's so hard. I want your input on this because for me, I don't want to just sit on my hands and ignore it or pretend like it's not there. But on the other hand, it's almost like Trump dominates the news to such an extent that it crowds out everything else. It's like I can't think of the last time that I gave Africa much of a thought because there's no room for all these other crises going on in the world.
Meanwhile, there's burning and looting mm-hmm. going on.
Yeah.
And so that's a good point. Is it a distraction?
And that's the thing. It's like, how do you know? It seems that with Russia and everything, this seems like it's damn important. But then maybe it is the little stuff sucks up so much of the extra oxygen, whether it's Melania, the porn star. It's like,
because it's salacious and it's what it's appealing to the prurient side of us. Mm-hmm. The question really isn't what we're against, because I think a lot of us are pretty sure of what we're against. What are we for?
Mm-hmm.
Is a Democratic congressman that is pro Wall Street and is going to vote for the next war when it happens? Is mm-hmm. that the alternative that we are being offered? And why is that the alternative we're being offered? And by the way, mm-hmm. he's a representation of Republicans throughout the country. They're just better at the coded language.
Mm-hmm.
To hide their racism and to hide their xenophobia.
Yeah.
So, in a way, he's kind of like this id that doesn't have a filter.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe he's doing us a service because he's exposing this is what the philosophy is mm-hmm. behind this political party. And this is the result of 35, 40 years of propaganda on the airwaves that started with the deregulation of the airwaves in the Reagan administration.
Huh.
So it got to a place where every day in certain places of America, you get about 6 hours or 9 hours of radio propaganda that is relentlessly pursuing an agenda of dividing us, making someone else the enemy. The person you thought was your neighbor is your enemy because he doesn't think this way. And that's something that's pretty new to America, because I remember growing up that you could have a difference of opinion with someone and still buy them a beer at the bar and have a discussion about it and agree to disagree. But we're both people, and we're going to sit here and be a community together in this moment.
Yeah.
So you have that. The question is, how do we get past this, and what are we for? What are we going to advocate for to change it? And if it's mm-hmm. if it's a change of moderation, if it's a change just to get simply a Democrat in there, then are we really going to see change, or are we going mm-hmm. to be back at the situation where there's enough disenfranchised people that are angry at the Democrats now that have once again voted a Republican in? So for me, the biggest challenge right now is that you have people in the Democratic Party, in the establishment of the Democratic Party, trying to drive a wedge between themselves and the more progressive arm of the party.
Right.
And for me, that is crazy, because you're talking about the real progressives. You're talking about the activists, the people mm-hmm. that will knock on doors and get the vote out, the people that really care, that do the hard work, that show up at rallies, that advocate on a daily basis for progressive values. Why are people in the DNC trying to alienate these people? I don't understand it.
Yeah, and you campaigned for Bernie Sanders in 2016. You've always been fairly politically outspoken over the years. As a working actor and director, do you feel that exercising your right to have a political voice comes with a price?
That's for other people to say. I would say that I would try to look at the positive of it. It's brought me relationships with some pretty amazing people
mm-hmm.
that I hold dear, I don't think I'd change a thing. Has it cost me work? I don't know. Those kinds of people that wouldn't hire me would never admit it.
Yeah.
So,
well, you wouldn't notice from looking at your career. I mean, I think you've done quite well. So.
I'm fine.
If it has an effect.
I'm totally fine, but maybe there's some parties I don't get invited to. But I don't go to parties anyway. So, but no, I think is important is that regardless of what effect something might have, it's most important for everyone to speak when it's important to speak,
mm-hmm.
not when it's convenient to speak, but when it's difficult. That's what the right is there for, the freedom of speech, is to give us the right when it's difficult.
Yeah.
The last time that was really apparent was when the war was being cooked up in 2003. And a lot of people were quiet. And for me, that was the scariest moment. Because people I knew, that I knew were against the war, were intimidated into silence.
Do you think that would have happened today with so many independent journalists on the internet and bloggers and podcasters doing their own thing, not within the structure of NBC, CBS, ABC, CNN, and Fox News?
Let's see, because I'm sure there's something cooking.
We might get the opportunity again.
Yeah.
Well, we were just talking about how fun it was to work with Alan Ball. You've worked with a lot of great directors, from the Coen brothers to Clint Eastwood, and I think you did at least three movies with Robert Altman. I heard you say that he was a great collaborator to work with. In what sense?
Well, first, in the fact that he was a hero of mine. I was really nervous to meet him, and he immediately, on first meeting, made me feel comfortable. Made me feel like my voice was important. And when he hired me to do the player, took me in as a collaborator, he asked me. And that was a rare thing for me because I was a writer and a director myself in theater at the time. And he was aware of that. And there's two ways that directors deal with that kind of thing. Either they don't hire you because they don't want the contribution. No one wants a backseat driver. Right?
Yeah.
But I've never done that, by the way, as an actor. I've always like, you know, you want to direct? Great. I don't want to direct right now. But no, but he, I remember one of the first days I was in his office and we were talking about the script and ideas for what we could change. And someone came in his office and someone on the crew and said, Bob, I have a question, you know, and asked the question. And Bob said, I don't know. What do you think? And I was
the Socratic director.
I was really impressed because I knew he knew the answer to the question.
Oh, interesting. So there was a little bit of mentorship there also.
In everybody.
Interesting.
In everybody in the crew. He made everyone feel like they were part of the process. Every night at the end of a day of shooting, we'd all meet in the production office and see dailies together. Wow. And then there'd be a little bit of food and some beer and wine. And so it was a real collaboration that I took with me when I wanted to direct my own films. I learned a tremendous amount from him.
And what a time to be working with him, because the movie that you did with him, The Player, was really his comeback movie. When you played that character, the smarmy studio exec, what was his name, Griffin Mill or something like that, were you drawing on some of your own interactions in the industry? Did you know guys like that in this town?
I did, and I actually, two executives allowed me to sit in their offices for
a
few hours while they took phone calls, and I listened in on the phone calls.
No kidding. Are they still working?
In some capacity.
Okay.
But it confirmed a lot of things for me, but it also, as you do when you research a part, it also illuminates subtleties and different complexities that you didn't think were there. So the whole idea of survival as a studio executive was, I think, what I took out of it, that no one ever wants to be wrong, and being wrong can cost you your job.
Yeah.
So,
which is why no one sticks their neck out and ever does anything interesting in this business.
Yes, and it's gotten worse since 92. So, but also the other thing that when we were in Cannes, I remember very clearly, we just won. I think Bob won Best Director. I won Best Actor at the Cannes Film Festival. The film was a huge hit, and Bob says to me, "You know what? I think we were too nice to them." That was his immediate take on it. He was like, I think we let him get away too easily.
Well, speaking of Hollywood douchebaggery, I know that you've dealt with Harvey Weinstein a few times over the years. I don't know if this is true or not, but I hear that he's a bit of a cad. What was your experience
Whatever
like?
Whatever made you think that?
Yeah.
He bought Bob Roberts, Miramax at the time, did a deal with Paramount. They bought my film Bob Roberts, which played in Cannes the same year as The Player did.
That's right. They were kind of parallel to each other.
And it was in Director's Fortnight, and it got great reviews. And so it came out of Cannes with a deal for distribution and a good contract that gave me Final Cut.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, over the course of the next 3 months, I got countless phone calls from Harvey saying, I want to cut this, I want to cut this, I want to cut this, you know? And I was like, no, it played really well in Cannes, and I want to keep it the way it is, and mm-hmm. I'm not interested in going back into the editing room, and I've got Final Cut. And so it was, you know, that was my first experience with him, and including a couple conversations that were kind of disturbing, where I knew he was lying, and he swore on a family member that he wasn't lying. It's just weird stuff like that that immediately kind of told me this guy was a piece of work. And then over the course of time, I think it was a couple of years later, I was offered a film. They had just done a deal with Disney. The brothers had just pocketed, I guess, $30 or $40 million each. And he was offering me a movie and going to pay me scale. And I said, Harvey, you just pocketed $30 million. When are the creative people that got your company there going to see some of that?
Yeah.
And he said he'd call me back. And an hour later, he calls me back and he says, you know, listen, I'll offer you $1 million, but you can't tell any of the other actors on the movie because I'm paying them all scale. And I said, Harvey, you don't understand what I just, you didn't understand what I just said to you. It wasn't me. This wasn't a shakedown. I was saying, when are you going to enter into the realm of paying people that are creative? And anyway, that was the last time I really worked for him. I mean, I did a favor for Altman on Pret-a-Porter, which he produced, but it had nothing to do with Harvey.
It's interesting that you say this wasn't a shakedown, because that's probably the only kind of thing that a guy like Harvey understands. He's someone who was such a rough character who just kind of operated on street smarts by the seat of his pants and by bullying.
But I grew up with that in New York City.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I knew this guy. Really? I didn't know him personally, but I knew that kind of guy. And just like I know the kind of guy Trump is from New York City.
Yeah,
you know, these operators, these con men, they're you can see them a mile away if you grow up around them, and so that was my instinct immediately with both of them.
What was it like to take that huge leap from acting, where you know you show up, you know your lines, you do your job, and that's really your whole responsibility, to directing, where you're in charge of this massive operation? I mean, it's every movie is a little bit like launching a mini D-Day invasion, it seems.
It's an apt metaphor, because I've often described it as a general, you know, someone that has to motivate the troops to go up storming up the hill.
Yeah.
And that was literally true one day on shooting. We had to shoot on top of a hill, and it was raining, and we had to get a crew up a steep incline to this hill to shoot this music video in Bob Roberts of called I Want to Live. And it's really exciting. It's really, I loved it. I had directed for many years in theater. I knew about that process. I knew about the process of rewriting, about the essence of the truth of what you're trying to get from actors and how to rewrite it to be that. So I got all that, but also acting in it at the same time, it was a big challenge. I made sure I knew all my lines. I showed up on time, and
that's right, because you were doing double duty on that movie.
Right, I tried not to get into too many fights with the director. You know, these kind of like fights with myself. So, but I also relied on a very solid cinematographer who I'd worked with on The Player. We had very little playback. We had playback for only the more complicated shots.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, because that's the way. Well, because I would never.
Money or why?
Well, we never would have made the day. If you get someone that just wants to look at their performance all day long, it's going to extend the day by, you know, 3 or 4 hours.
Did you find that helpful creatively as well?
It's just most in the idea of just let it go.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know, go move forward.
Yeah.
Get the day done.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Tim Robbins when we come back in just a minute. Hey, fellas, it's time to freshen up with high-quality products from Dollar Shave Club. Dollar Shave Club has razors, shave butter, shampoo, body wash, toothpaste, everything you need to look, smell, and feel your best. I get an amazing high-quality shave every morning from my Dollar Shave Club Executive Razor. It really is the best razor I've ever used. It has six blades. Six! I probably used that one razor every day, and it was still giving me a clean shave even after 2 weeks. And I gotta tell you about their Dr. Carver's Shave Butter. It is downright luxury for your face. It smells great, it's easy on my skin, and it goes on clear, so you don't have that poofy white shaving cream beard. You can actually see where you're shaving. But Dollar Shave Club is so much more than just shaving. They're now my go-to for toiletries, my hygiene guru. Quality products at a good price automatically resupplied every month straight to my front door. And since DSC delivers everything to you, you don't have to set foot in a store. I love that most of all. Clean up your bathroom and your morning routine. Join Dollar Shave Club today, and for just $5 with free shipping, you'll get the six-blade Executive Razor plus trial sizes of shave butter, body cleanser, and one wipe Charlie's. Then keep the blades coming for a few bucks more a month. Get yours at dollarshaveclub.com/kickass. That's dollarshaveclub.com/kickass. Listen up, millennials and serial procrastinators. When you're young and you're fresh out of college, you've got your hands full with the day-to-day stuff. You're focused on getting a job, dating, paying your rent, which doesn't leave much room for thinking about the long term. But you gotta grow up sooner or later, at least a little bit, and that means thinking ahead and protecting the things that matter to you. Did you know that 71% of people say they need life insurance, but only 59% have coverage? That means at least 12% of people are procrastinating. And sure, normally procrastinating is a bad thing. But if you've been avoiding getting life insurance, congratulations, because while you were procrastinating, Policy Genius was making life insurance easier. Policy Genius is the easy way to compare life insurance online. You can compare quotes in just 5 minutes. And let's be honest, when it's that easy, putting it off becomes a lot harder. You can compare quotes while sitting on the couch watching TV. You can compare quotes while listening to this podcast. Policy Genius has helped over 4 million people shop for insurance and placed over $20 billion in coverage. And they don't just make life insurance easy, they also compare disability insurance, renter's insurance, and health insurance. If you care about it, they cover it. So if you need life insurance but you've been putting it off because it's too confusing or you don't have the time, check out Policy Genius. It's the easy way to compare top insurers and find the best value for you. There's no sales pressure and zero hassle. And best of all, it's free. PolicyGenius.com. When it's easy to compare life insurance, why put it off? And now, back to the podcast.
You know, I have to say, I saw Bob Roberts when I was just a kid, when I saw it with my mom. But I remember thinking it was so cool and so smart when it came out. Now, I think you're positively a soothsayer. I mean, looking back, do you feel almost omniscient when you see the parallels to everything that's going on today?
Well, how can I answer that question? I feel like we hit a lot of truths with that character of an emerging political archetype, the rich man that wants to go into public service. And there's something about that I just don't really believe. You know, it started with the idea that, for the Kennedys, certainly they were from a very wealthy family. And I think there was a sense of service with them. But then this kind of yuppie Republican started to emerge in the 80s. And I didn't think there was a lot of altruism behind that. And so I wanted to portray that kind of hypocrisy, the idea that someone with a well-oiled machine and millions of dollars can essentially present themselves as a populist and get elected, and then serve the masters that got them there. It's playing out right now.
There's
no swamp being drained. It's just getting a lot murkier.
I mean, in some cases, I think that it feels like there are exact lines from that movie that I've seen on the news.
You think he watched it as a political strategy?
Maybe. Well, you also wrote the songs for Bob Roberts as well.
With my brother, David.
Yeah. Doesn't that kind of run in your genes? I think your dad was a folk singer. Is that right?
That's right. He was in a group called the Highwaymen. Had quite a few successes in the early 60s and did some touring. And we lived in Greenwich Village, so we were around the folk scene. My dad worked at the Gaslight Cafe.
The 60s and 70s, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Wow, that was the time when everything was happening there.
So I saw some pretty amazing things as a child in the Gaslight Cafe. You know, Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee live, Cat Stevens live before he became famous. Richard Pryor, I snuck in one night.
You're kidding.
And my dad kicked me out. Said, how'd you get in here?
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
I saw some pretty cool stuff. And the whole culture at the time of Greenwich Village was such an interesting culture, which I've never really seen portrayed properly on film. It was a really interesting mix of the most progressive, artistic, creative people and old world conservative values, old world immigrant, Italian and Irish, a clash of cultures.
Yeah. I mean, what is it like for you now when you return to the village and it's taken over by hipsters and yuppies and every corner has a Swedish furniture store or artisanal cupcake place?
I wrote the first draft of Bob Roberts in 1985. When I was back there doing a film called Five Corners. I'd been away from my neighborhood for about 6-7 years at that point, and already it had transformed. So I originally wrote a short film for Saturday Night Live of a yuppie folk singer, but not a politician. So
And so we filmed the proto Bob Roberts.
Yes, it was Bob Roberts, but it was before he became a politician.
Oh wow!
So I filmed in all the locations in Greenwich Village that I knew. They were still around, like the Village Gate and Cafe Reggio, and I did these this short 5-minute film about this yuppie folk singer. So for me, it was the Italian bakery had been taken over, and the new space was David's Cookies. That was the first franchise that I noticed. And that was, for me, the beginning of the end for that. I try not to be one of these people that is like, I remember that. It used to be so great. Because it used to be dangerous, actually. It was a lot more dangerous to live there. But there was something about that that perhaps was more vital to creativity. I think that Manhattan, it's a big challenge right now because real estate is too expensive in New York right now. And it's happening in other cities, but particularly in New York and San Francisco. When it's impossible for a young, creative musician, visual artist, actor to come out of college and go to a certain area, impossible economically, I think part of the city starts to die. Because your young creative talent that is pushing the envelope is no longer there. It's all people that are entitled.
Yeah.
And entitlement doesn't create great art.
Yeah.
In the 70s, it was dangerous in New York, but you also had this amazing musical thing happening.
Yeah, and I think that kind of gets to something that's been your life's work. And I don't think that a lot of fans may know that you have this wonderful acting company called The Actors Gang that's been around 35 years. You basically started that when you were starting out in acting. I think pretty much, were you straight out of college?
We started it with a production of Ubu the King by Alfred Jarry that I directed as a one act in college. And we took the cast, or most of the cast of that, and I found a theater in Hollywood that would allow me to perform the play at midnights on Fridays and Saturdays. And so we shared the theater with another theater company, and we came in there at 10:30, loaded our stuff in, and performed. And it was a big hit, and it ran for 6 months. It was a really wild rock and roll crowd. And that's what started the Actors Gang, the success of that. And through the course of the years, I've particularly in the beginning, I was able to put the money that I was earning doing episodics and sitcoms appearances into theater immediately. And so,
really, own, isn't that the first rule? You never put your own money in the show.
Yeah, well, I disagree with that because it allowed me an opportunity to write and direct. And,
oh yeah, okay.
It gave me an opportunity to learn how to do that.
Interesting.
And so, 35, 36 years later, we're a theater company that's traveled all around the world. We've been in five continents on in 40 U.S. states. We dream of a lifetime performing in an ancient Roman amphitheater.
Oh, that's cool.
And in Lyon, France, in Spoleto, in Italy. It's been a really amazing journey. And the other thing that the Actors Gang allows me to do is work on what I want to work on.
Mm-hmm.
I am lucky enough to have not been stupid with my money. And I really don't have to continue to work as an actor. I choose to do it when I like the script. And I know how blessed I am to be able to have that freedom, and it's a luxury in a way. But when I have free time, I get to go to a place where we all talk the same language, where we have a common vocabulary on stage, and I can develop new pieces with this great group of talented people that I've been training for many years.
So it's sort of like your own little personal lab where you can indulge your inner mad scientist and experiment with new forms and do things that you might necessarily be able to do within the confines of the quote-unquote entertainment industry.
Right. It doesn't take a ton of money to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't, you know, we can do any kind of material. We can ask any question. And the one we're doing right now is a direct result of that. It's called The New Colossus.
Yeah.
And when I went, it was two, three years ago, we first started working on it, where we asked ourselves the question, what is a refugee? The Syrian refugee crisis was happening. There was a lot of kind of rhetoric in the news media, somehow conflating this massive refugee problem with the potential rise of terrorism. And I was like, what are you talking about? These people are women and children that didn't want to die. And to conflate those two, it was so offensive to me.
Mm-hmm.
So we started asking ourselves the question in the company, where are we from? And so all of the actors researched their own families' journeys.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
And so we had stories.
So they're telling their own story or their family's story.
That's right.
Wow.
They're telling their ancestors' story. And so we have everything from 1868 to 2017.
Mm-hmm.
We have recent and people that, you know, immigrated a long, long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a common experience. As Americans, we all are from somewhere else, unless you are an indigenous person in North or South America. And even then, there's a mixture between the indigenous and those that settle. So really, we're all the same, right, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, the experience is universal for every American at some point in their family tree.
Right, except for African Americans, people that were brought here against their will.
Right.
A lot of whom don't even know what country they were stolen from. Or their ancestors were stolen from. So we tell the story in The New Colossus of the migration within America that happened post-Civil War during the Reconstruction.
Oh, interesting.
That blacks that were free now were being targeted with violence and intimidation and had to get the hell out of there. And that's how that mass migration to Detroit, Chicago, went up the Mississippi River for freedom. The same story that we tell of someone from Eastern Europe that had to get out of there and flee communism to get to America, or someone from Iran in 79 that had to get out of there because they were going to be killed. It's the same story.
Yeah, it seems to me that it's just so unbelievably illogical, this idea that someone from another place is going to risk everything, leave their family, deal with all that heartache and all that fear, just so they can come to a new place and completely ruin that country.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It just doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense, and it's based in fear and mm-hmm. lies, and it's a narrative that we wanted to tell, an anti-narrative towards. And what's really beautiful about the experience so far for me has been to be able to stand in front of the audience at the end of the play and ask them, where are you from?
Yeah, I heard that you do that. And you have the audience tell their stories,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah, and amazing. We hear the most That's amazing cool. stories
I'll
of
bet.
Survival and strength and courage that they're telling of their grandfather or their grandmother who risked their lives to get here.
Wow.
And escaped certain death
yeah.
from where they were leaving.
I'll bet. I mean, that kind of audience participation is sort of indicative of the innovative things that you do at Actors Gang. You also incorporate, I guess you would call it a commedia dell'arte style, into another effort at Actors Gang, which is the Prison Project. You go into California prisons, and what kind of work do you do with the inmates?
Essentially, we do the same thing that we do in our own training. Every Sunday night, we do a workshop, and we develop new pieces, and we train our actors. And at the core of it is the commitment to states of emotion, mm-hmm. Happy, sad, angry, and afraid, mm-hmm. and the ability to switch from one emotion to another. And so it's accessibility to emotion that is at the core of it. We use the commedia dell'arte because it provides characters. Stock
right.
characters.
This is with the masks or what?
Well, we use masks. Uh-huh. We can't bring masks into prison, so we bring makeup
okay.
and they paint their masks right,
okay.
on their
okay.
faces.
Wow.
But the idea is that they're characters that we all know, mm-hmm. accessible characters. The old rich man that
right.
wants to
Archetypes.
Marry. Yeah, he wants to marry his daughter off to a business associate for money. And she doesn't want to do that because she's in love with this younger mm-hmm. man who's beautiful, but also a little bit poorer.
Mm-hmm.
And so the conflict in the commedia dell'arte scenarios has to do with the challenge of getting those two who love each other together and letting true love win. And in the course of the scenario, also the servants in some ways trick or humiliate their master, their old rich guy. So we've seen this in so many cultures. It's a
yeah.
story that is so accessible.
Is anyone being tied to a railroad track?
If you like.
Okay. All right.
But the point being that it allows them to rely on the archetype of the character mm-hmm. so they don't have to create a character out of whole cloth. And most importantly, that when we're dealing with their emotions, we're giving them a buffer to portray those emotions through.
Yeah.
It's not psychotherapy. We're asking them to play. We're asking them to be angry as the Harlequino or be mm-hmm. sad as the Pantalone. So
interesting.
They are able to access these emotions, sometimes emotions they have not expressed for many, many years.
Wow.
I've had them tell me I haven't felt that kind of emotion for 30 mm-hmm. years. Because in prison, survival is a perpetual state of anger or aggression.
Mm-hmm.
On the yard, if you are sad, you're compromising yourself. If you show any fear, you
right.
are compromising yourself.
Right.
Happiness is sometimes expressed, but it's usually in mockery of someone, not necessarily mm-hmm. in true joy. So what this allows them is a safe area where we have a group of people that we have asked be racially diverse, and across gang ties.
Oh wow.
So and we ask not for
That's
the
bold.
We ask not for the trustees, but we ask the well behaved, but we ask for the people that they feel need the help and that possess a certain amount of power on the prison yard. So that the work we do inside these rooms can extend beyond
the influencers. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what happens is it breaks down these barriers that are self-imposed out of survival. You do not, in particularly, I know it's true in California prisons, and I suspect it's true throughout the United States, you don't cross racial lines mm-hmm. in prison. It's a compromise.
Yeah.
So to be able to do that in the rooms where we're working, to be able to express emotions, when I get, you know, 20 guys up on stage and I take them to a funeral of one of the characters and they're all expressing their last moments to the corpse that's in front of them, and that you see them getting into this state of sadness based on probably experiences they've had, but also because there's probably funerals they couldn't go to of loved ones mm-hmm. because they were incarcerated.
Yeah. And that's incredible.
And to see them in this state of vulnerability and then to ask them, okay, now look in each other's eyes. And that's the moment where, for me, it all turns, because they are able to identify empathy in each other. That's a huge thing. That's not something you can see in prison on a daily basis or ever. And so then to say, and if you would like, you can comfort the other person. Hardened people that have done things that are, you know, that they should be in prison for. Taking the steps to try to better themselves, try to open themselves to the idea that they are in control or can be in control of their emotions. They are the master of their emotions, mm-hmm. not the victim. That's a big thing. One of the guys said to me at one point, he says, this guy comes up to me in the yard and he gets in my face. And, you know, before I took this class, I would have just gotten into a fight. I would have gotten a 115. I would have gotten more time on my sentence. I looked at him. I saw his eyes. I didn't buy it. He looked like someone from the Commedia dell'arte, and I just started to laugh. And it completely diffused the situation.
Yeah. And the recidivism rate, I read, is apparently way lower among the graduates of the prison project than the general prison population's recidivism rate, right?
Yes, it's significantly lower. And we have an 89% reduction in 115s, which are in prison infractions for anyone that's been through
the program. That's really great.
So it's working.
Yeah.
And for me, it's a public safety issue.
Mm-hmm.
If you have no rehabilitation that works in prison, you're just asking for more trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that 97% of the people that are in prison are going to be getting out, wouldn't you want them coming out with better tools to deal with challenges,
what's the point if not?
Struggles than when they
Absolutely.
Went in?
Absolutely. Now, do they ever bring up Shawshank Redemption?
Yes, they do.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That gives some hope that there is such a thing as redemption and second chances, and hopefully will be another chapter to your life. This isn't the end. So
it's also...
It really resonates.
I was thinking about this the other day. The heroism in that movie is related to building a library.
Mm-hmm.
And playing Mozart, not in some fight, not in some, you know, winning some game.
Yeah.
It's in broadening your vistas, the capabilities of your mind and your soul and your spirit.
Inspiring words. Well, before we wrap up here, just two quick questions for you. A couple things that I've heard over the years. Once you heckled Henry Kissinger... Is that true?
I did, yeah.
And you donated $500 to Michelle Bachmann?
Yeah, apparently.
Was that
I did.
A larger play? You were trying to thwart some other candidate? I don't understand.
I don't understand it either. Apparently, I think the way I remember it was that I read this article about Democrats that had supported the Iraq War.
Oh, okay.
And who was running against them?
Okay.
And I was really angry that Democrats supported that war.
Yeah.
So I did make a mistake.
So you supported her to thwart the Democrat.
I didn't support
Democrat
her. I just
who...
threw her some money. I didn't do any campaigning. I just was like, I got some money. I'm angry at this person. I'm going to make them pay. But my point is, though, and by the way, the Henry Kissinger thing was in front of my son, which was really interesting because he was young at the time, and I yelled something at Henry Kissinger.
Why are you harassing that little old man?
And he said, what was that all about? I said, well, that guy was responsible for a lot of death in Cambodia. And then I filled him in later in life about the details of that. But, I'm I guess that's all I have to say.
Politics makes strange bedfellows.
I wouldn't
it?
Even say it's a bedfellow. I would say it was a bad drink I bought for someone at a bar.
Well, again, folks, you can watch Here and Now on HBO and definitely catch Tim's play, The New Colossus.
It's extended through May 12th on Saturday nights only at the Actors Guild.
Okay, folks, go see it. Tim Robbins, it's been fun. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Tim Robbins for coming on the podcast. The New Colossus is playing now through May 12th at the Actors Gang in Culver City, California. For tickets or to learn more about the Actors Gang and the Prison Project, visit theactorsgang.com. See Tim Robbins and Alan Ball's excellent new series Here and Now with a subscription to HBO, HBO Go, or HBO Now. And keep up with Tim at timrobbins.net or on Twitter at timrobbins1. Folks, if you're an entrepreneur, a small business owner, or even if you have a side gig, let me introduce you to Grasshopper, the entrepreneur's phone system. Grasshopper lets you send and receive calls and texts from your new business phone number. That way, you can run your business from anywhere and respond to clients quickly with Grasshopper's mobile apps. Grasshopper, sign up today. Go to grasshopper.com/kick to get $20 off your first month. Again, that's grasshopper.com/kick. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.